it was very, very emotional. And I think there was, after the sentence, there was somewhat a sigh of relief.
A man is sentenced to 203 years for killing two state troopers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 3rd. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, unusually long lines for early voting don't deter the masses.
I have too many obligations next Tuesday, taking seniors to vote.
Stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. From military might to counterculture cool to camo chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
After 6 days, the body of missing pilot David McRae and his plane have finally been found in Lake Clark National Park. Lieutenant Colonel Candace Olmsted directs public affairs for the Alaska National Guard. She says weather cleared enough today to get close to the area. The Civil Air Patrol helped with the search and ultimately found the site. McRae and his plane, a single-engine Pilatus Porter, were found at an altitude of 6,500 feet. But authorities have not described the crash site or any apparent circumstances. He had been flying from Lake Hood to Lake Clark through Merrill Pass Friday evening when his plane went down. Colonel Olmsted said pararescue crews got down to the wreck site today.
They hoisted down to the site and they were able to find Mr. McRae, and they did recover his body and transported and released him to the state medical examiner.
His next of kin were notified. Weather had hampered search efforts since last weekend. 55-year-old McRae was a longtime and respected bush pilot. The man convicted of killing two Alaska state troopers in the interior village of Tanana in 2014 was sentenced yesterday to 203 years in jail. 22-year-old Nathaniel Congas was convicted of the murders of Sergeant Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich. Colonel James Cockrell is the director of the Alaska State Troopers.
It was very, very emotional, and I think there was, after the sentence, there was somewhat a sigh of relief, too, and because, I think it helps in the healing process.
Cockrell says the courtroom was filled with law enforcement, community members, and the families of the slain troopers. Nathaniel Congas was convicted in May on two counts of first-degree murder and one count of third-degree assault. Cockrell says he's satisfied with the trial's outcome.
There's not any more serious crime that you can have to premeditatedly kill two law enforcement officers who are acting within the scope of their duties in a professional way. There was nothing that we did that provoked the actions of that Nathaniel Kangas shooting both of our troopers in ambush.
Each murder charge carries a mandatory 99-year sentence, and the assault charge carries an additional 5. Kangas also faces fines and more than $2.5 million in restitution payments. Cockrell says the troopers' deaths accentuate the need to cultivate stronger relationships between law enforcement and local communities.
Because it doesn't matter the amount of training that you have when you're in an ambush situation. You're essentially, you can't train for that, and you still have to be free and open to contact citizens, and you can't always be on your guard, and certainly they have an upper hand. So the more we work within our communities, I think the better off we are as a agency, more effective we are.
Nathaniel Congas was convicted of shooting the troopers when they came to Tanana to arrest his father, Arvin Congas, who had threatened a village safety officer with a rifle. Arvin is serving time for evidence tampering and is eligible for parole in several years. Judge Lyle ordered no contact between the father and son in order to ensure the safety of corrections officers. Dorothy Homage, a reporter with the Fairbanks News Miner, has been following the case and was in the courtroom during the sentencing. She says it wasn't as crowded as at the trial, but for the first time, many of the victims' family members made statements.
They were, of course, it was, you know, gut-wrenching. There were a lot of tears in the courtroom. There was, especially after Sergeant Johnson's wife spoke about how difficult it is to raise her children, the hold that his death has left in their lives, and how she's having such a hard time moving on. It's been draining on everybody. I mean, everybody most of the people there knew both of those troopers, and it was hard to hear, but they got through it, and hopefully, maybe now, they may get some closure. I don't know, but at least the process is over.
Did Gabe Rich's family have anything to say?
His father said it broke his heart that his grandsons would grow up without their father and never get to know what a loving, compassionate, charismatic person he was. And then his father, whose name is David, he leveled most of his ire, I believe, at Kangas's parents, Irvin and Judy. And he said, although I agree you should spend the rest of your life in prison for what you did, the real criminals in this sad affair are your parents. Your father for setting an example of misplaced hatred, mistrust, and blatant disrespect for authority, and your mother for her ignorance and apathy.
Did Nathaniel Kangas seem to show any remorse, or did he say he was sorry?
He did say he was sorry, yes. He said, I know they were good people, and I'm truly sorry. He's a very quiet young man, very subdued. Sergeant Johnson's wife did request that he turn and face her while she made her statement. And she kept her head down, and he would glance down and then occasionally glance up at her and blink and glance down with his hands clasped, kind of rubbing his thumbs against each other. But he did sit there and he listened. But what else could he do?
That was reporter Dorothy Holmich, a reporter with Fairbanks Newsminer who attended Congress's sentencing hearing. Across the country, the number of people voting early in the general election is up. It's not clear from the numbers yet whether Alaskans are keeping pace with that trend. But as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, people on the ground say it's the busiest they've seen.
It's around lunchtime at the Division of Elections regional office in Anchorage, and Martha Apixon came to vote. But she's turning around, heading back towards the parking lot.
If you look over here, the line is to the door.
Apixon is a super voter, someone who dutifully turns out for every election. But this is the first time in 40 years of casting ballots that she's doing it before Election Day.
I've been hearing about early voters. I've been following the predictions. And I just thought, well, I think I'm going to give it a try.
Apixon isn't annoyed by the line. She just has other errands she's got to run and thinks it'll be less busy later on. Another early voter, Michelle Palmer, is in an upbeat mood even though she waited 40 minutes to cast her ballot. But Palmer says she had to vote today because she's out of time.
I have too many obligations next Tuesday, taking seniors to vote.
Palmer, too, votes in every election, and that's also true for Richard Miller, who says the 15-minute wait for him was completely painless.
And normally I vote on Election Day, but I know I was going to be out of town on Election Day, and so came down to do it. And this is the biggest crowd I've ever seen here.
That seems to be the consensus around Anchorage and around the state. As of Thursday, about 46,000 Alaskans have voted. That's only about half the number of early votes cast in the last presidential election, but there's still a few days left, including a weekend, and ballots are still pouring in by mail. Local and state officials say that from their perspective, the early returns are strong.
It's an exciting election.
Julie Hussman is the election supervisor in charge of Anchorage and says her staff is processing thousands of voters a day at sites across the municipality. She doesn't have the hard numbers yet, but says from the looks of it, it's busier than the elections that she remembers. Still, she isn't hearing any complaints from voters.
People have not complained. I'm going to tell you, the people have been great. They said, I'm amazed at how quick it's going. And I said, well, how long did they wait? And say, oh, 15, 20 minutes.
There's still a few days of early voting, including Saturday, or you can take your chances on Election Day, November 8th. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unexpected World Series win hits home.
Feels surreal. I mean, I keep kind of pinching myself and saying, and, you know, kind of crying.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 directory for older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
There's a constitutional amendment on this month's ballot that could impact student debt. It would allow the state to borrow money in order to lower the interest rates on college loans. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on what both sides have to say.
The Alaska Student Loan Corporation lends money to Alaskans to go to college, but the number of students who receive these loans has dropped steeply. That's in part because fewer students can afford the interest on those loans, as well as the fact that fewer students qualified for loans after the state raised its credit standards. While the corporation was started by the state, it has to pay more to bondholders than the state government does. That's because the loan corporation's bond rating isn't as high as the state's. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon sponsored the ballot question that could eliminate the difference.
My primary purpose is how can we do something at no cost to the state of Alaska that would help students that are carrying an incredible amount of debt.
The Alaska Constitution limits state general obligation bonds to capital projects, veterans housing, and emergencies. If enacted, the amendment would allow the legislature to seek voter approval for bonds to back current and future student loans. Former corporation executive Diane Behrens told legislators earlier this year the measure would also allow more students to borrow because their credit scores wouldn't have to be as high as they are now.
We have about 40% of the applicants who do not qualify and are unable to get a cosigner.
Not everyone supports the amendment. Former State Revenue Commissioner Sterling Gallagher says student loans are too risky for the state to use its own bonds, since many students don't pay off their loans.
If we want to lower the credit ratings on student loans, let's do it based on known cash flows, not on some grab of the state's general credit.
McKinnon counters the state already faces the risk of paying off student loans in default, but students don't benefit from the state's higher bond rating.
The risk that is there today is pretty much the same risk that would be there tomorrow if voters voted yes.
Only two lawmakers, Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman and Wasilla Republican Representative Lynn Gaddis, voted against the legislation putting the question on the ballot. In Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
One of the most watched races in the state is happening in and around Fairbanks, where two longtime politicians are running in a matchup that could help decide control of the Alaska Senate. The incumbent, North Pole Republican John Coghill, faces a challenge from Luke Hopkins, a Democrat and former mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. As Rachel Waldholtz reports from Alaska's Energy Desk, the race hinges on how each candidate would approach the state's budget crisis.
Democrat Luke Hopkins got into the race with a splash last May, releasing a letter in which he wrote that the legislature had utterly failed Alaskans. Hopkins says lawmakers ducked their responsibility when they left Juneau without passing a long-term plan to deal with the budget shortfall.
I got really concerned that there wasn't a sustainable fiscal plan, and I thought that that's what the state really needs, and I still believe in that very strongly. Especially for the interior of Alaska.
He says incumbent John Coghill, who served as the Republican majority leader, bears responsibility for that. It's a line of attack Hopkins' allies have driven home. Here's an ad from the outside group Together for Alaska, which favors higher oil taxes and is largely funded by labor groups and the oil and gas attorney Robin Brenna.
Look, State Senator John Coghill, he's a nice guy, but his priorities are so messed up that we need to replace him and other do-nothing legislators.
The accusation, do-nothing, is because somebody wanted one particular thing and didn't get it.
That's John Coghill. He ticked off a list of the legislature's accomplishments. Budget cuts, Medicaid reform, criminal justice reform. The Republicans in the Senate even passed a bill to restructure the permanent fund and use the earnings to pay for part of the budget, though that idea died in the House. The problem is, the things they got done aren't all that popular. The permanent fund restructuring, for instance, would have cut the PFD in half, something Governor Bill Walker later did himself. But Coghill says they were necessary. He's particularly proud of the criminal justice reform bill, which he sponsored.
The thing that I think got my attention more than anything is that two-thirds of the people coming out of prison were going back within 3 years. And that's just not an acceptable rate of criminal justice return.
He says a major goal was to cut the prison population and direct more people into behavioral health programs, cutting down on recidivism and saving money at the same time. The final bill included a wide range of reforms and won bipartisan support. Coghill says the legislature needs to take that approach and apply it to two of the biggest areas of state spending, education and health and social services.
And this is where Luke and I would probably disagree immensely. We have 130,000 students, and our outcomes are not that good, but our costs are way high. I'd be willing to look at, can we do it better? Can we do it more frugally?
And that might mean distance education or consolidation, he says. Coghill says he's open to a statewide sales or income tax. He'd prefer a sales tax. Or even revisiting oil taxes, but only as a last resort. Like Hopkins, Coghill has received significant support from outside groups. One is the Accountability Project, which has received contributions from business, industry, and Republican groups. They helped pay for this ad attacking Hopkins.
Hillary Clinton and Luke Hopkins, two liberal peas in a pod. Higher taxes, more spending, bigger government.
Hopkins. But Hopkins says lawmakers kicked the can down the road when they didn't pass new revenue measures in the last session.
We have to come up with a sustainable fiscal plan, and there's huge holes in it. And I don't think, and I agree with the governor's assessment and the administration, that we can't cut our way out of this.
He opposes any new cuts to the university and wants to preserve education funding. And he says Coghill and Republicans were too quick to cut the permanent fund dividend and dip into savings. While those actions are probably necessary in the end, Hopkins says he wouldn't support them until every sector of the Alaska economy is paying its, quote, fair share. That means revisiting oil taxes and doing away with certain tax credits on the North Slope. It also means an income or sales tax. He says an income tax would be more fair. And it means looking at the whole slew of new taxes proposed by the governor last year, from motor fuels to mining and fishing.
And look at these, compromise as necessary, and vote them up or down. But the issue is that what do we want our state to look like in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years from now, when we see that the oil revenue is probably not going to be coming back? And so that's what we have to prepare for. What kind of state do we want to see?
How the district's voters answer that question could have ripple effects across the state. Political observers say the race is one of two that could flip control of the Senate, along with the Anchorage matchup between Republican Kathy Geisel and Labor leader Vince Beltrami. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
The Anchorage School District has a new public webpage that lets community members comb through district data. You can look at maps showing which schools have the best attendance or charts highlighting which students have the best reading comprehension. It was introduced during a hands-on workshop last night where community members were already putting the tool to use.
What are you looking at? Do you see any of the data that you're going to need for the grant?
Teresa Lyons sits with her colleague, Kelly Ferran, looking at a computer screen filled with graphs and maps. They both run programs at the University of Alaska Anchorage that help students succeed in college, programs that rely on competitive grants.
And we recently lost a couple of them. We're writing for three now.
Lyons and Ferran are looking through the school district's new data dashboard for information to add to those grants. At first, Ferran didn't see anything they really need. Then she realizes how far the information can be broken down.
This might give us a better idea of if we can look at, say, freshmen, how many have received an F in their core subject. We can see if they're on track.
It seems a little dry at first. It is data, after all. But Lyon says having easy, efficient access to these large chunks of information means they can draw resources to the areas that need it.
So being able to prove the need is what we're seeking to do so that, you know, our grant could be considered as valuable and important to our community.
She also says it's valuable to her as a community member to be able to see what's really happening within the district. ASD Superintendent Dina Paramo says administrators are already using the dashboard to figure out how the district needs to change. She says the data highlights disparities, like the number of Fs received by different student groups. And that indicates that the district is failing those kids. She says they're using the information as a whole to figure out ways to adjust teaching styles and to ask different questions.
These data aren't to find fault. They're actually to say, okay, here is a space where we are not meeting the needs of kids. How can we change that?
The new dashboard includes information on test scores, attendance, discipline, and other measures of student achievement. It does not include school characteristics like class size, overall school demographics, or spending on professional development.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
The general election is November 8th. Polls are open at 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. You will be voting for United States President and Vice President, United States Senator, United States Representative, State Senator, State Representative, judges, and ballot measures. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need help with the language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring someone to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
For over 30 years, the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies in Homer has organized its annual Coastwalk Cleanup. As part of the program, hundreds of volunteers collect trash on Kachemak Bay beaches, and many return year after year to the same stretch of beach. KBBI reporter Shayla Farzon has the story.
You don't need much equipment to collect trash on the beach. A plastic grocery bag is a good start. But if you want to pick up trash with pros like Lonnie Raymond, you'd better bring a knife.
This is a very dull knife.
Raymond uses a pocket knife to saw at an old piece of rope buried deep in the sand. She's been cleaning up this same stretch of beach in Homer for the last 14 years as part of the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies Coastwalk program. On a windy September day, Raymond and two other volunteers walk the beach east of the Homer Spit, carrying plastic grocery bags to collect trash. After a while, all the trash starts to look the same, she says.
Almost every beer can is Budweiser. Don't you think that's odd?
Raymond also collects a lot of fishing line on the beaches. It's easy for animals to become entangled in it, she says.
When we're finding the dead birds, we often find them that they're entangled in fish line or they have a hook in them.
A small group of volunteers started the Coastwalk program in the mid-1980s. When the program began, the trash on Kachemak Bay beaches was a little larger.
There's pictures of trucks being taken off the beach and appliances and construction materials and that sort of thing.
That's Beth Trowbridge, the executive director of the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. Over the last 10 years, Coastwalk volunteers have recorded a shift in the kind of trash collected on the beaches, she says.
There was definitely a noticeable shift in the 2000s where things shifted from that sort of commercial construction type of debris to personal recreational use. You know, fishing line, plastic bottles, plastic bags, candy wrappers, food wrappers, containers, that sort of thing. So there's been a huge shift.
This year, 550 Coastwalk volunteers collected over 1,600 pounds of trash from Kachemak Bay beaches. The Coastwalk program has become so successful, in fact, that it is now being used as a model for other communities in Alaska, including Kodiak, Sitka, and Kotzebue.
What's really cool about Homer and our community is that, you know, statewide, we're known as a leader in terms of caring about the ocean and our stewardship model.
This year's Coastwalk ran from September 8th through the end of October. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzon.
Last night, an estimated 40 million people tuned in to the Game 7 of the World Series. What they saw was history in the making. The Chicago Cubs beat Cleveland 8-7 in the 10th inning to win their first title since before World War I. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early talked with some local Cubs fans about finally seeing their team win it all.
That sound was coming from Megan Baldino's living room last night as she and her friends and family watched the Cubs win the World Series for the first time since 1908. Baldino is a former reporter for KTUU in Anchorage. She now works for GCI. She's also a lifelong Cubs fan from Chicago. Like most fans of the team, Baldino has been waiting for this moment her entire life.
It's truly unbelievable. It feels surreal. I mean, I keep kind of pinching myself and saying, and, you know, kind of crying and saying, wow, this is really happening. We just won the World Series. And in a game like that, I mean, it was outrageous.
Another longtime Cubs fan, Matt Navalla is a former sports writer for Anchorage Daily News. Navalla said the moment of the big win was an emotional one.
The first anecdotal thing I can think of that was pretty funny was my 8-year-old daughter saying out loud that she'd never seen her dad cry before.
The game was particularly nerve-wracking for Cubs fans when in the bottom of the 8th inning, Cleveland scored 3 runs to tie the game at 6-6 going into the 9th, and later an extra 10th inning. The suspense gave Navalla mixed emotions.
There was this weird kind of calm to it of, okay, let's see what happens here. They either bag it and go down, horribly, or they find a way.
For Megan Baldino, the up-and-down nature of that moment was crystal clear.
You know, we went to the depths of despair when they tied it up, And when that happened, I had a bunch of people at my house last night, and I did not sit the whole time. Someone said, you have a Fitbit on because you are just pacing. And so you go to that place again, like, God, no, don't let it slip away.
It's been 108 years since the Cubs last won the World Series. That's a lot of history passing by without a baseball championship in the Windy City.
If you saw the broadcast last night when they're saying, Mark Twain was 71 years old or something in 1908, or Halley's Comet has come past not once but twice in that time. And, it's part of what you see all these pieces when they're talking to celebrities, and it's part of this lifelong commitment you make to that franchise and to that organization, to the game itself.
Even though it took more than a century for the Cubs to win it all, many fans believe 2016 is just the beginning for the team.
Overjoyed. This feeling's not going to go away for me. And let me remind many people that Chicago is a city with a great history of teams becoming dominant, the Bulls with Michael Jordan, the Blackhawks recently. And so I am supremely confident that the Cubs will continue to be, at least for the next couple of years, one of the strongest teams in baseball.
For Navalla, it's the end of a journey that started when he was just a boy.
This all started for me from the fact I played backyard baseball with the same group of buddies when we were, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And you'd spend all day in the backyard playing, and then the Cubs would come on in that afternoon back in Michigan where I was from. And it just kind of becomes part of what makes your DNA and what makes your insides work, if you will. And this was the ultimate payoff.
Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz, Josh Edge, Andrew Kitchenman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Shayla Farazan in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
GCI, keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media. Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.